We like to start on time and we like to end on time. I'm Mindy Greiling. I'm the chair of the K-12 Education Finance Division. And before we have people up here to introduce themselves, I'd like to call on Superintendent Willard to come up. He would like to do a welcome to Marshall. And also, I'd ask him if he could facilitate having all the dignitaries in the room introduce themselves. So, Superintendent Willard, thank you.
Well, on behalf of everybody here at Marshall Public Schools and the larger community, we'd like to turn out this evening and welcome to our public school building and our district. I'm really glad to see so many people turn out for such an important issue as possible. I've talked about the number of K-12 funding and the direction of K-12 funding for our school systems across the state. And we're absolutely delighted to have Representative Diedrich and Representative Ryan join us this evening. It's a beautiful night. We know that there are many other political issues going on this evening, namely the vice presidential candidate debate. We certainly want to honor people's time to recognize the opportunity to serve that as well. In order to facilitate recognizing those that are here, rather than simply going around and having everybody name themselves right away out of the room, what we're doing is I would ask that the superintendents that are in the room would first stand up and then state your name and your district that you represent so that we can then move into board members that are here, and the district that you represent, and then other people that are here as well, and the district that you represent. So, all superintendents, why don't you stand up, and then as you say your name, be seated, and we'll facilitate the process that way. Rick, why don't you begin?
Yeah, I'm Rick Ellingworth, and I'm Superintendent of Schools in Logan Falls.
Board
Director, Kevin Hogan.
William Winstead, Winnery School.
Ted Stout, the Master School.
Rick Clark, Buffalo, Hector Schools.
Dave Monroe, Grayson.
Lewis Falls, Grayson.
Thanks to all the superintendents that are out this evening. We appreciate you coming to this meeting. Now we would ask that all school board members that are present today would stand and be recognized in much the same way. We'll start right over here.
Jim Buckley from River Falls. Steve Schiller from Burlington.
Linda Mullen from Worthington.
Chris O'Reilly from Worthington.
Matt Coleman
from Marshall.
Since Weston Marshall.
Mary Dwyer, Adjunct, and MRA.
Phil Olson,
Marshall. Mike Doak, Marshall.
Charlie Bruce, Department.
Thank you to all the school board members. I would ask that anybody from the service cooperative will stand up. I believe we have one representative at least. If not others, please stand up and be recognized.
My name is Rod Hocker. I work for the service cooperative.
All right, now other people that have not yet been recognized, please stand up, state your role along with your district or the agency that you represent.
John Cole, Finance Director of Falls.
Staff Director of House Supervisor of Religion.
Mark Randall, I'm the Director of Plum Creek Library System and Utah Public Library System.
Very good, and I know that we have a couple of people, Lee Warren from MREA, and Bill Delaney, he's the superintendent of Gilmer Public Schools. So Representative Dryling and Dietrich, we do have a great deal of representation throughout the region, and I represent many different agencies, many different school districts, and obviously many different districts. So on behalf of all of them, we welcome you, and we look forward to hearing.
Thank you very, very much. Superintendent Willard. And all of you, it's a wonderful audience, and we love it when we have informed people that really cut to the chase on the input that we're seeking, and then just general input as well is always welcome at these hearings. And most of the hearing we hope to be hearing from you. But first, I'll have the two people to my left introduce themselves, then I'll go through kind of the general game plan for the evening, and then we will get around to the list of you. So first I'd like Representative Dietrich to introduce herself.
Good evening. As Representative Gravin said, I am Representative Denise Dietrich. I represent the city of Champlin and part of the city of Coon Rapids. And both of those suburbs are about 20 miles northwest of Minneapolis. And I just want to make one little side comment here tonight is that I took a little walk before the hearing started, and I could see people, kids up playing football, people jogging, people biking, people out on their motorcycles, and I thought, boy, the people that come here tonight really have a commitment to public education in order to give up their time on a beautiful autumn day like it is today. So thank you for coming.
Hi, I'm Greg Cron, the fiscal analyst for the Education Finance Committee in the House of Representatives.
And Mr. Crow is a nonpartisan employee, so we like to have people to make sure that all our information is fair and balanced and not partisan. And that's how we like to run education, and that's certainly how the new Minnesota Miracle was developed. I just want to say about myself, though, before we get into that, for me it's very fun to come here because my grandfather was born in Ghent. And I looked it up on the map with the bus driver because I knew it was near Marshall. I've never been to Ghent. And we noticed it's probably less than 10 miles away. Does any superintendent here cover Ghent? Okay, both of you, because that's the line. I guess Lee Warren was telling me that it's in two different school districts. But my grandfather and his parents came to a farm right outside of Rochester, about 6 miles north of Rochester. And my grandfather's grandparents stayed in Ghent. And then later they also migrated to southeast Minnesota. And we never knew why they did, you know, if they were financially in trouble and lost the farm, or just why they made that move. It's lost in our family history. But for me to be here, it feels like a little bit of my risk. We have, as you know, probably been having hearings all around the state, and we are collecting up input because this bill that we introduced at the very end of session will be reintroduced on the first day of session next year. So that's why we're so interested in making sure that people all around the state critique the bill and tell us if we need to change it in any ways before we introduce it again next year. And then, of course, it will be a big topic, probably the topic of discussion in the education finance area, not probably, it will be, during the session. So we really want to get a head start and have these hearings. It came about, Representative Dietrich and I don't take full credit for it, even though we did work on it. Of course, because it's toward the end of the campaign season, we normally have more legislators from our committee, but we are taping the meeting and they will have a chance to listen, and then we're also taking good notes when we get input. But this started out with a task force from Governor Pawlenty on school finance, chaired by Rick Dressen, the superintendent at Alexandria, who's now in Edina. They got a certain ways along, and then, as you know, PS Minnesota picked up the ball and funded John Myers and his company to come up to take the plan further and get it more refined. And then that was passed along to the legislators, and we had a bipartisan Senate House Commissioner Segrin task force that came up with this proposal, and all the legislators, the Democrats and the Republicans that were on the task force, signed on to it, and then many more legislators did as well that wanted to support it. And so now we're wanting to get your input. We took the proponents of PS Minnesota to try to have a simpler system so that people could understand it a little bit better, but we wanted to preserve, as they recommended, the need-based funding that would be funding the different types of students. We recommend full funding for special education, and then also funding the different types of districts. They did recommend keeping local control, so there are still levy referendums, but all the other funding is made as equitable as we can make it based on the cost differential given to us by PS Minnesota. I always call it the Eiffel Tower because all these different pieces that are in the bill, the different types of funding for the different types of districts and the different types of students, can work together in a very nice form, and we could agree upon those principles even if we didn't put a dime into the bill, but then the Eiffel Tower would be just a small balsa wood bottle. But if, and then if we can scale it in, if we put the full amount in, the $2.5 billion, it would be a life-size Eiffel Tower, and if we put different amounts of money in, it would be, you know, a growing Eiffel Tower as able. We obviously have a very difficult financial situation that we're heading into with the deficit. So our state economist tells us that if we invest in education, that is the best way, actually, to stimulate productivity and the economy. So that's what we're kind of looking at. We want your help to know if you got the pieces right in the Eiffel Tower. So let's straight into that, and I'll first call on Mr. Crow, who has about a 15 or 20 minute presentation, just so everybody's got a working knowledge in case you didn't, I'm sure a lot of you came to that. But we'll go through this PowerPoint on the bill, and then we'll hear from you. So, Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair and members, we'll do a quick PowerPoint as you mentioned. We'll start out with start out with some highlights from the session that just closed. The 2008 session added $51 per pupil to each district's general education revenue, as I'm sure you're all aware of. There's a, if you're interested, we didn't bring the printout tonight, but there's one available on the House website that shows how much your school district's getting. I'm assuming with budget setting and whatnot that you've already looked into that pretty closely. In addition, the legislature authorized a $51 per pupil transfer from the capital operating fund to the undesignated general fund. There was also an increase in the lease levy and an authorization of a special levy for districts that lost money due to a federal audit of the local collaborative time study program. Then for fiscal 2010 and later, the legislature removed the reduction that districts have of the amount of permanent school fund revenue they receive to allow that to be additional revenue, which amounts to about $36 per student or $30 per AMCPU compared to the 51 that we saw on the previous occasion. And as Representative Garland said, you can look on page 4. I think you should have a handout that has these slides. Page 4 has the background of how House File 4178 was developed, starting with the task force convened by Governor Pawlenty in 2003. As Representative Garland stated, the goals of House File 4178 are adequate, equitable, more fair, and simplified funding system that is scalable to allow for phasing of retirement. Some general characteristics of House File 4178, the basic formula, or what some people still refer to as the foundation aid, is set at a level that is high enough to fund up basic instruction, and then additional components are added that would that provide additional funds to districts based on specific characteristics and needs. In addition, the cap on special education is eliminated, so districts receive the full amount of special education funding that are eligible for under the state formula. As I'm sure most of you know, the state formula funds about 68% of salaries for special education teachers, so it doesn't cover 100% of those costs, but it pays for 100% of what the state formula is. There are additional options for school district facility needs that we'll get into in a second, and additional equalization on some property tax levels. So what are the details of House File 4178? As part of simplification, all students, including kindergartners, are counted as 1.0 in pupil units. Under current law, the pupil units for kindergartners are 0.612, and then there's a growing pupil count, or growing and then shrinking as you go up through the grades. And so the first thing that 4178 would do would be to count all pupils as one. This, in addition to simplifying the system, will also creates a funding mechanism for all-day kindergarten. As in current law, students will be funded based on the district where they're served, not their resident district. So the basic formula allowance increases from $5,124, which is what we have for fiscal 2009 under current law, to a proposed $7,500 per pupil. One thing to note is that when we go to 1.0 on pupil counts, on the pupil count, we eliminate a lot of pupils in the state, or pupils in terms of funding formula. Obviously, there's the same number of kids, but because the weighting's gone, there's actually a lower count. So the first $600 to $700 of that increase is just kind of a hold harmless to make sure districts don't lose money because there's fewer pupils counted. And then the bill calls for an inflation of that $7,500 each year based on the growth in the implicit price inflator for state and local services. One of the components then that's included in current law as well as in House File 4178 is additional funding for districts with high numbers of students in low socioeconomic situations. And rather than having a concentration formula like we have now, the curve for the funding kind of gets flatter rather than the steep growth that we have now with districts with higher concentrations. In addition, there's a floor, and that floor is calculated as 33% of the formula allowance. So initially, it'd be $2,500, and any student that's eligible for free or reduced lunch meals would generate that additional $2,500. And then there's a concentration factor. It's 40% of the formula allowance, and it's calculated at a district level rather than at a site level as under current law. So a district with high numbers of students that aren't concentrated, particularly in any one building, would qualify for a larger amount of compensatory revenue under 4178. As under current law, there's a limited English proficiency revenue. The primary differences are that 4178 links the limited English proficiency revenue formula with the basic formula. It's 20% of the formula allowance. And under current law, it's a fixed dollar amount that's significantly lower than that. In addition, under current law, once a student has been eligible for funding for 5 years, the funding ends. Under House File 4178, the funding would continue until the student no longer qualifies by becoming proficient in English. Then, because under current law, our declining revenue formula is built into our pupil counts, and House File 4178 takes that away by making all pupils count as one rather than using the adjusted marginal cost pupil unit program we have now, a new declining enrollment revenue is created and basically averages a school district's enrollment for 3 years and provides additional revenue based on that 3 year average of enrollment. There's an additional categorical aid in House File 4178 called the Location Equity Index, or LEI. What that is a revenue for districts with high wage costs or housing costs, measured on a county basis and equal to 50% of the formula allowance times their index. And at this time, only the 7-county metro area would qualify for Location Equity Index. The current sparsity formula is modified by currently it goes to small geographically isolated school districts, additional districts will qualify for additional funding because the sparsity distance is reduced from 19 to 15 miles. An additional revenue reserve is also created in House Hawk 4178, and it's called innovation revenue. And what is required is that districts set aside 1.5% of their basic revenue, and that's the money from the $7,500 per pupil. And the expectation is this would fund research-based practices that improve student performance. Districts that aren't making adequate progress as measured by something that Representative Brown can talk a bit about, but it's not enumerated specifically in this bill. But districts that aren't making progress continue to receive the revenue, but they have to file a plan with the Department of Education to state how they're going to allocate that revenue and improve student performance. There are some other reserves. 1% reserve for gifted and talented rather than the revenue that's under current law. 0.5% for career and technical programs, and that's over and above the current revenue that districts get in the form of the levy. And then there are existing reserves that are kept for basic skills, operating capital, and staff development programs. So overall, there's some streamlining of general education revenue with that simplification goal in mind. And some of the programs that are eliminated are training and experience revenue, equity revenue, transition revenue, the pension offset, the gifted and talented as a separate revenue, and the QCOM revenue. On the referendum side, as Representative Grinling alluded to, there was a goal in the bill of trying to reduce some reliance on property tax levies. One method to accomplish this was by offsetting every district's operating referendum by $500 per pupil, and then adding that $500 back into the general education program as a separate revenue source that's all state aid. For districts with less than $500 per pupil of operating referendum, this will provide extra revenue. For example, if a district is at $300 per pupil, they'll have that levy reduced to zero, and $500 added to the general education revenue, so it'll net $200 to the better. Any district that's at $500 above, it'll basically be a revenue neutral change, but it will provide state aid versus local levy. On the special education side, as I mentioned, the statewide cap on special education revenue was eliminated, so all districts received the full funding of the state formula, which is 68% of eligible special education funds. In addition, the cap on excess cost revenue for districts with rapidly growing or high special ed costs is also eliminated. Eliminated, providing full funding for that program. On the transportation side, there's a new hazardous transportation aid, which allows districts to self-identify hazardous conditions and ask for additional funding from the state to pay for those transportation, those additional transportation needs. Basically, those additional costs cannot exceed 20% of the district's regular transportation to and from costs. In addition, the state will provide 5% state aid, 5% of the district's transportation costs in the form of state aid to be set aside for bus purchase. And the funding for districts that contract would also go to those districts, but could be used for the additional contract costs. On the facility side, currently, only large districts are eligible to levy for deferred maintenance. House Bill 4178 would allow all districts that opportunity. Also would increase debt service equalization aid, so districts would lower the bar for districts attempting to pass building bonds. And then there's also an agricultural school bond credit that reduces the impact of bond levies on districts with high proportions of agricultural loans in their property base. Other property tax reductions include increased equalization levels on most of the major school funding formulas that remain that have an aid and levy component, indexing of those equalizing factors to the growth in the state property tax base, which make sure that the state participation in that equalization continues as property tax base grows, and finally the elimination of several levies, including operating capital equity transition and QCOMP, and the offset of $500 of referendum revenue. There's a chart that's pretty tough to read that shows where revenue is under current law for each of the components of general ed and special ed, or general ed, and where it would go under House File 4178 and the net change. A couple of things to note. Sometimes, for example, under declining enrollment, there's a zero under current law. That's because the declining enrollment revenue is built into the basic formula. So some of those you have to look at a little more carefully. We wanted to include, and these show up great on the overheads, we wanted to include some links to the some more resources on the House website that relate to school funding in general and House File 4178 in particular. In your packet, I just want to point out one thing. You have a spreadsheet that's on a board that's laid out horizontal. And what that is it shows baseline revenue compared to the proposed revenue under House File 4178, and it shows it with and without with and without referendum revenue increase or included. And you can rate it from left to right. It's fairly self-explanatory.
Thank you very much, Mr. Crowell. Before we go to testimony, we've of course been joined by your own local legislator, and so you might like to say a few words. Welcome,
Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you all for coming tonight. I'm going to keep it very brief because I think we're more interested in what you have to say than what I have to say. First, I want to thank the Chair and Representative Dietrich for coming down. The Chair and I have served in the legislature for 12 years now together. We may have some disagreements in some things. We had mental health issues some years ago, and I had some constituents who have the same issue that she's had in her family, and we really tried to make some big progress on that in the last few years, and we have. And we did. And Representative Dietrich, I have to say, when we were in the majority, she was my heroine on small business issues. Not heroine that you snort, but heroine. my female hero. She was very good at supporting some Main Street issues that were important to our district on some wage mandates for small businesses. And so I appreciate you making the long trip down to Marshall. You know what? I drive now.
I go back and forth.
You're more sympathetic when I leave that 8 o'clock at night, get home at midnight. But I'm very interested. I want to thank Representative Dryling also for presenting the plan, and for Greg, of course, our able nonpartisan staffer, for explaining it. And if you do have questions on things, he can give you kind of the straight shot on what it costs or where money comes from and goes. And we have universal respect for him on both sides of that. So thank you for coming tonight. Thank you to the panel for being here, and we'll go ahead, I guess, and have the chair take over for testimony.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich. We're going to go with the green cards to begin with, and four people have turned them in. We're going to go in the order in which they were turned in, and if anybody else, while these people are testifying, wish to testify, we have two staff people in the audience, Liz Mandelman and Carmen Carter. Liz and Carmen, if you could raise your hands. There's Carmen. Okay, Liz is out there in the hallway. And so they have the green cards in the hallway. If you would like to sign one, they will shuttle them up here, and then we will hear from more people. And we will end at 8 o'clock. We usually hang around a little while because people sometimes prefer to talk to us one-on-one, and they don't want to go to the microphone, especially when we were in Thief River Falls, where they said there were just a lot of Norwegians up there. They wouldn't go to the microphone, but as soon as it was over, they flocked about us because they wanted to talk. Tonight, since it is the debate, I have a feeling there will be less of that, but we'll see. So we'll start out with Superintendent Clint Willis.
Again, Representative Ryland, Eastern Cypher, glad to be all here this evening. And as I begin my comments, I need to first tell you a little bit about myself. I'm I believe I represent what is really the promise of this education bill as we looked at what it means for educational funding for schools. I grew up in Southwest Minnesota, graduated from the little town of Burdock. And some other people in this room know exactly where that's at. Interesting little school. I actually had more people in my family than I did in my graduating class. I left Minnesota. I went to South Dakota to pick up my education to become a teacher. Traveled to Montana to become an administrator. And then my first child was born. And all of a sudden, it changed my perspective on everything. And I wanted to get back. I wanted to get back home and get back to my roots. And for a couple of reasons. One, the quality of life that I experienced as a resident of Minnesota. But just as importantly, if not more importantly, what that meant for my children and my son at the time and now my daughter. I have two children. My son is 10 and my daughter is 7. Both of them are the apples of my eye, and people in this room know that I speak of them often and very affectionately, of course, as you would with your own children. And that's why I'm really excited about the opportunity that this bill presents as you look forward to and look through what it means for our community in particular, but as our state as a whole. We know that we're facing a very critical time. In fact, I would argue the most critical time for investment in education that this state or this country has ever faced. We look at what's going on both domestically and abroad. We know that we have to provide our students with an education that not only makes them, provides them with a competitive advantage, but with a moral imperative to carry on the things that they're expected to do as they represent the values of Minnesota and represent the values of our communities. When we look at those things that are challenges that we face, we know that we face growing standards. We know the economic impact of a growing economy in China, India. We also know that we face challenges when we look at the quality of education in the United States as it compares and benchmarks against some other countries such as Singapore and Finland. And we know that we collectively want to provide our children the opportunity to be competitive against those foreign competitors because they are, in a global economy, our global competitors. And that's very important to remember. And we know that in order to do that, we have to meet the standards that have been established in our state. We also know that in order to do that effectively, we not only have to use functional skills, being able to add, subtract, division, and those types of things, but we also know that we have to provide some of those more creative skills, teamwork, critical thinking, design, adding meaning to life through those various elements and modalities. And I think as I look and listen to what you just presented, many of those things are achievable with this bill. I do have a concern, and I'll get to those in a bit, some things that I would just like to reiterate that I've heard that I believe really are critical as we look at what I see as a strategic direction and not tinkering towards perfection. Because from time to time, the legislature has been known to do such a thing. Special education is a significant issue here for our school district. As we stand here today, the cross-subsidy in Marshall Public Schools general fund dollars to special education exceeds $1 million annually. That is a significant issue. And the needs of our special education students are growing. While the population of our special education students may not necessarily be growing because of the challenges that we're facing with the needs of the mental dimensions and mental health issues, those are only a small fraction of the many issues that we face in our classrooms and our teachers are expected to address daily. We know that we have growing minority populations in our communities, and we embrace them openly. In fact, the last meeting that I had the day prior to coming here was with our minority advocate, and we spoke very long and hard about how to engage our minority community, particularly our minority parents, in the schools. I see some resources here that will help us achieve those goals and objectives. As I look as well at early childhood investments, we know in order to best meet for the objectives and the needs of our state, our community, we start early and we start often. And research has needed that out time and time and time again. So critical investment in early childhood education is also very critical. I also am very appreciative of the discussion about the deferred maintenance. We look particularly here at Marshall.
You may smell the faint aroma of tar as you walk on your walk, Representative Beecher, because you are undergoing an initial roofing project at this time. But with that comes some other costs in other areas. We know that we want to be on the leading edge of technology in our community and provide those opportunities for our children. There's current research out there that talks about the fact that by 2019, over 50% of all college, or excuse me, 50% of all high school courses could be provided in an online format. It's in the book if you're interested, or disrupting class. We don't have the capacity to do that. We're faced with tough choices on roofs to protect our infrastructure inside, or investing in technology, and risking running the risk of losing that technology because of a dripping roof. Another issue that's part of that, our current nonfiction collection in this building, the nonfiction collection in our library books in this building, 1991 is the average age. Why is that? Because we've made strategic investments in other areas within our facilities, but it's been at the expense of other opportunities for our children. So I'm very appreciative. As I look at some concerns that I see as we look at this bill, number one, the basic weighting of one for every child. But that's a concern, particularly for Marshall Public Schools, is as a school system, our high school is a feeder or serves as an organization that has multiple feeders that come into it. And we stand to lose revenue for our high school system as we look overall collectively and what that means. What am I talking about specifically? We look at our parochial partners in the school system, in our school district, and they feed our high school and students from Marshall Lutheran Christian School, San Diego Christian. We also receive students from outlying districts that include Lynn and Millroy, and of course, our largest parochial presence in the community, Holy Redeemer School. So when we look at that weight, and that is a concern. I also believe I speak on behalf of many of my colleagues when we look at the LEI, the Location Equity Index, I believe I said that correctly, where I see that as potentially the divisive component of this bill, particularly for Greater Minnesota. It's good for the students in an urban setting, it's good for my child, right here. That means equitable funding across the board. And I'm very passionate about that because I believe my child has the same opportunity or needs to have the same opportunity as another child somewhere else in the state. And that should be decided based upon the cost of my house versus the cost of somebody else's house. Finally, I would like to say that I do have a question and concern, and more of a question as much of a concern, on a few components of this bill. Marshall has been, and I would argue with anyone, the foremost leader with the most progressive alternative compensation package in the state of Minnesota. And that goes through a great deal of collaboration with our teachers, some of those who are present here this evening and your representatives. It goes through a great deal of collaboration with our school board, who is also present this evening, not to mention our community as a whole. They have stepped forward and collectively embraced this idea of being goal-oriented, performance-driven, based upon strategic outcomes that we've established based on strategic direction collectively as a community. I'm concerned when I fear that we potentially could be losing that revenue stream and wondering what that really means to us in our plan, in our program, and in our budgets. Those are just a few of the comments that I would like to make, and as I close, I want to say that currently on behalf of the 2,000 plus students that I represent and that I am responsible to advocate for in this community, currently, and I am a young superintendent, so the thousands of students that I intend to advocate for in the years to come, thank you for at least taking a very hard look at something that's important not only for me today as a father of two young children, but ultimately grandfather of two children that are future residents of Minnesota. So thank you and have a great evening.
Thank you, Superintendent Lillard. And before I call up the next person, who will be Mark Branham, as long as we just have four people so far, I'll just make a couple responses to your questions. One is early childhood. This is the case law committee, but we're very supportive of early childhood. And they are working on a counterpart for early childhood. Because, of course, that is the cheapest, most moral way to address the achievement gap, is to help get some school ready to learn. Technology, Representative Dietrich had a bill this year where we hope to have a stable, permanent, and growing fund for technology, as was requested by TF Minnesota. And she had had the, for the first time, the permanent school fund not go to the general fund, but instead go to schools. And in the House, we all supported having that be dedicated to technology. It's going to be a growing fund because of the mineral development in our state. But unfortunately, when we conversed with the governor and the Senate, they were convinced that we so needed the money in school districts that not to dedicate it would be a better thing, at least for the short term. So we lost out in that endeavor, but we hope to send representatives again to the thick of the fray again, and we count on her to help us get that this time. And then the high school heavy part of it, we took the one from the PS Minnesota, and as Mr. Crow said, that extra money on the formula, there's a lot of extra money that's meant to account for that. But we realize that districts that are high school heavy don't get accounted for as well as those who aren't. That's true. QCOS is something that was actually in this plan until the very last minute before we did our press conference, and we took it out as a bargaining chip. The commissioner was going to come, and the governor at the committee anyway asked her not to come and be part of it. So we decided, we know the governor likes QCOM, he actually liked it too. It's bipartisanly cast and supported, but it's out for now, and I'm sure it'll be back eventually, but it does cost them another $260 per pupil. One of the points of PS Minnesota was, if something's a good program, then don't have pilots for it, have it be available for everybody. And so in this bill, we actually initially funded it for every single district that chose to be in it, instead of the first in line got it and others did not. All my districts have it. They love it. It's a professionalization of teachers, and teacher quality is what we talk about a lot right now. So I have every confidence that in the end it will be that again. And then lastly, the location equity index. We do hear, of course, different points of view of that as we go around the state. It's a mathematical formula because of the high salaries that are not just teachers, but also the bus drivers, the cooks, the clerical workers, the paraprofessionals, and it's an equity, not for teachers. The teachers union doesn't even want that equity because they think all teachers should be paid the same. They don't like that part of this proposal either. But it's for students, actually. The goal of the bill is to have all students wherever they live get an equitable education. And if you can buy two teachers in one area for the same price as three teachers in another, then it's not an equitable situation. It came from PS Minnesota, from the national expert. Pennsylvania actually just passed it in their education finance reform, where it is not quite so controversial because they have more regional centers. It isn't a metro area against everybody else. They have different regional centers. What we're trying to do with MREA is work on something more refined so that it will apply to more gradations with more areas of the state, because I agree with Superintendent Willard that it's a divisive issue. But the metro area feels strongly about it being an equitable thing for the students, and it is a mathematically costed out thing. So I'm sure we'll be talking about that a lot this year. The next, and I promise not to talk anymore in between all the others, but those were things I thought I wanted to address because we feel strongly about things like QCOMP and early childhood. Mark Brannon.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'm from the Eastern Commission, I think I've seen someone who's been good evening. My name is Mark Branham. I'm the director of the Plum Creek Regional Library System, the public library system that serves the nine southwest counties in Minnesota, including the Marshall area and Lyon County. I just wanted to make sure that you had a chance to talk about the other partner in education, and that's public libraries. All of the 12 regional public libraries support the movement, so you're going to see support from the library organizations as well across the state. Partly for the reasons that we know libraries are that other half of the education piece. We talk about quite a bit with our school partners about how their media centers are and their libraries are not able to be funded. We heard from Superintendent Rhodes, I think, about the choices, the very difficult choices the school boards have to make and the school administrators have to make. And public libraries want to step up to that challenge and be part of that education solution for the kids who are looking to continue their education out of the building in the summers whenever they need information. Just a couple of points. In this region in particular, we have 25 public libraries on the same automated system that allows us to share materials, but we have 8 schools as well. So we actually have gone out and tried to partner even more closely with the schools than some other public libraries to get kids access to those materials, to allow them to get access to the databases, and to make sure that they have the full range of materials available to their school libraries as well as their local public libraries. We also have almost 30 bookmobile stops. We're out in those small communities. We're connecting with kids who are not only, you know, being bused home and then they have no access to materials unless they happen to have some access electronically, but we're also trying to support other people in education, whether it's parents providing homeschool activities, whether it's some of the private schools, the small schools that are out there, some of the charter schools. We're really trying in public libraries to make that connection between information resources and success in school. We also know that schools and public libraries share the same technology infrastructure. The programs that support technology in the schools also support technology in the public libraries, and those need to maintain their strength. Obviously, you know, in a digital age, we need significant digital infrastructure to support pushing out information, classes, databases, whatever it is. And that network has just been getting stronger and stronger in the state over the years. Certainly, we're having users of it. You'll see public libraries where they're not only having ITE classes held in the public libraries, but the tests are being administered by public librarians and proctored by public librarians, willingly and gratefully knowing that we're that other partner for these who are doing distance education. The other aspect that I want to talk about since we're in Marshall is the values of the community. I think that you heard this, I feel a little bit like whoever followed the Beatles on that element, but still, you know, this is so significant when you're in Marshall, a community that's raised about $5 million now for a $6 million public library. You'll see the sign right next door about future home of the new Marshall Lyon County Library. And, you know, we've got infrastructure investment all throughout this region. You know, small town of Edgerton just put forth a huge amount of capital dollars for a new city office building that included more than half the space for their public library. That's been increased it because of the demand in the community. We've got infrastructure investment going on all over the region for public libraries because education is that value of rural Minnesota in particular. That doesn't mean it's not a value for everyone around the state, but this kind of school funding project, this infrastructure investment in school funding generally, helps to raise the success level for public library funding and for education success generally. And that carries from preschool, into school, out of school, and throughout people's lives. And that's what makes for a healthy and integrated community in terms of education services. So I want you to know that we support that, and from a system point of view, we're trying to work as closely as we can. But we are grateful for the support that you've given public libraries and schools together in the new Minnesota Council.
Thank you very, very much. Doug Nelson.
Madam Chair, and members of the committee, my name is Doug Nelson, and I teach high school science at Redwood Falls. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I just came here tonight to talk about how important funding is here, especially in rural Minnesota, greater Minnesota. My chair has to suck up a little bit. Superintendent Dillingworth and the school board have done a wonderful job.
But I honestly,
you do mean that. Just in the fact that for us, budget cuts have been, or staff cuts, excuse me, have mostly been through attrition. So, but I know that's not the case throughout this area. And but I have felt some of that pain. I teach bigger classes than when I started. I've also had to see some of the difficult decisions that we've had to make that were false just because of funding. The uncertainty of how many students are we going to have next year? Since if our enrollment declines, where are we going to make those cuts at? So, for instance, before we didn't have to charge students a parking. Now we do have to pay an parking lot. Students have to pay an athletic fee, which now is more than what we had when I first started at Redwood Falls 8 years ago. So, my point is, we need more equitable funding and funding that's more sustainable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Rick Clark.
And the audience holds their breath.
Drum roll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Seifert, it's good to see you the second time in the last hour. Mm-hmm. I met up on the highway. I'm one of those who rode a motorcycle. I anticipate being praised by the campuses. It will be chilly. I'm a superintendent of a small consolidated school district, and we're in the process of visiting with several of our neighbors about the possibility of turning this into a countywide school. So we are looking at our future, attempting to work with it and not being forced into it. Part of the challenge, of course, is the new boiler in the 1916 building is a 1953 boiler. So we have a few challenges. My concern is that in Minnesota, growing two items by constitutional requirement of transportation, which does not have an idea or an identified fundraising source, but we have a dedicated fund source to it. But under the prior article, education was listed first, and it says the legislature may accumulate funds for that. So my question is rhetorical to you folks because you can't answer it. But the question is, education is number one on the list. It was created by a founding process to perpetuate our society. And as we know, it's a pretty good one. It is flawed, but it has challenges. We have no designated funds, and therefore we stand at the whim of the legislature, which normally, I am told, holds it to the 11th hour as a bargaining chip. And so our future is played a political game of partisanship. Both sides and independents are guilty of that. The legislature takes an oath of office to support the state of Minnesota. And it's my belief that the state comes first, and the job of the legislature from those districts are required by their oath of office to see minimal or no damage to their constituents, not to court it. My concern is everyone from the federals down to the locals seems to be me first. I took this job, kids first. I'm rather passionate. My members are going, where's he going now? I'm from New Jersey, which explains some of it. I have no cousin, Bolio and Vinny. I come from Florida, 24 years in South Dakota, the poorest paid teacher salaries in the United States, who wrestles from time to time with Arkansas and Mississippi. I am blessed to be in this state. I am blessed to be working with kids. My question to the legislature is this. In 1999 and 2000, the state legislature said we would take over full funding of education. My question is rhetorical. How does one fund something that has not been defined? No one has said what Minnesota education is or should be, but you're funding it. You leave that local. We play back and forth between AYP requirements, state standards, and local control. Too often, for example, Grenville County has six school districts in it, has $500 million worth of taxable. I'm able to generate $196 million, the rest is taxable. My concern for the location equity is that it is expensive to live in the burbs. I know that. I lived in the fastest growing community in the United States in 1968-69-70. I understand those challenges. However, I drive 50 miles round trip to the grocery store. There is expense in that. That is equitable. I bought a house knowing full well there is no market for it. When I sell it, I will lose money. And the house is a major issue with a driver in the suburbs and the metropolitan area now. And so equity is in the eye of the beholder. And when we become divisive with a 7-county versus an outstate, outstate still represents 49% of the states. And the question is, what are rotations? Are we taking money for gasoline taxes? How is that being divided? There is no vision. And it lands on the steps of the legislators each and every year. Because there is no long term, there is a term that I've heard frequently, and that is we cannot tie the hands of future legislatures. But we do. Every year, we say the past is the benchmark, and we must move forward from there. So my question and my challenge to you folks is, first of all, thank you very much for addressing something different. There's some good things in here to start with. There are some things that certainly will need some addressing. However, it is a change. Continuing to address the same old with more fidgeting in the formula, especially when Mr. Melcher is considering retirement in the near future, will be a substantial challenge for someone else. I'll second that emotion. Because it is a challenge to figure 26 pages of the formula and go back through and check and find out if there are any errors. Add that to the fact that the state has now taken over billing and invoicing for special ed services. I don't think I can figure out what I've paid or what I've owed for at least 18 months after the bills have been paid. I still have to do the work, check to see if the work was done properly in the first place. That's on top of the Department of Education that has been badly cut. I didn't think I'd ever be standing in front of a group of people saying they need help. There are good people going twice the load, and when your officers are answering the phone at 6:45 in the morning, it tells me they're overloaded and they're headed for a breakdown. We can't afford it because they're supposed to be our supportive industry. So that was my pitch for those folks. But what I'm asking is, how does one fund something that is not defined? I believe the state of Minnesota needs to define what an education is. I'll be glad to go to my taxpayers to pay for the extras. But there will be divisiveness with this equity index as it is laid out now. Thank you very much. I hope I didn't embarrass this to death.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Dr. Clark, you did very well. And I will just say that PS Minnesota did define their financial recommendations as enough money for all the kids in the state, wherever they live, to be able to pass the test, federal and state. That was how they defined how much money. And our task force with the legislature changed it to enough money so all kids can graduate with success, ready for success, whether they go to college, university, technical school, or they go right into a good job. So that was kind of our definition. This is how much money is needed for that. And PS Minnesota unabashedly called it a Chevy model. And when we were in White Bear Lake for one of our hearings, Superintendent Blazing, who is retiring, so he can say whatever he wants, said it isn't enough. The Chevy model isn't enough for us. So that's one of the things we've heard. We now have a half an hour left, and legislators can talk, but we actually came to hear from you. Lee? And anybody else, you can skip the green card if there's time and there aren't any green cards. You can be, just raise your hand like he did. You can identify yourself in the case.
I'm Chair, but you know, you could represent Cypress Blue Horn, Minister of Education Services. I need to thank you for not only tonight, but you've done all over the state, having hearings like this and talking to folks everywhere, even in Beaver Falls, Nashua, elderly, Marshall, and places all in between. The last time that I remember that there was a legislative initiative like this, I think it was a long time ago, Randy Peterson, I think it was the first accountability legislation for PBR, if I remember it. And so I can't thank you enough for taking the effort to come around and talk to everybody all over the state. Everybody was going to read that legislative report. Secondly, I can't help but distract that there is something for everybody to like in this bill, and there is something for everybody to leave in this bill. And the process, the discussion that are ahead of us certainly will lead some of those things out there, and things will probably change some and modify a bit. But I thank you for the discussion and for the courage to lay this out so that we can have this debate.
Thank you very much. We have a green card. Mike, what? Welcome. If you could restate your name.
Thank you. I'm Mike Cook. I'm in the Marston School Board here. And let me just thank you all for coming out on a gorgeous night for thanking us. And thank you. You guys had a much longer rather than a less day. Coming into the city. So thank you for your time and efforts. And as one of the many leaders in this room of our recent local levy that we passed last year, a lot of us know how inadequately funded our schools are and the problems in our formula. So we just express our appreciation and the effort to try to do something about it and try to restore some of the sanity to something that we've all struggled with here. And unfortunately, our community belief in education and belief their kids that live in the family, and they really came out strong for passing our local levy, which is significant. But we really need to do something better in terms of providing the statistics. So thank you for all your efforts. Two quick comments. One is, let me reinforce the comment that Superintendent Lloyd made. This is great QCOP. Our QCOP efforts here have been embraced by our teachers, by our administrators, and by our school board. Our community, and we've just achieved some really great things. In some of our school board meetings over the last several months, we've had presentations from some of our local teacher committees that are actually working on continuous improvement efforts. And the things that they're doing are just really incredible in terms of trying to help improve the way all the teachers are teaching their kids. And this has been a huge component of it in terms of enabling that effort. And enabling some of the dialogues we've had with our teachers and with our administrators. So I would really encourage you to find a way to give something back in and continue to reinforce that overall performance goal and help us continue a continuous improvement effort that we love this story. If you need anybody to come and talk about some of the success, we'll all volunteer to give them up for you. The other thing is I would encourage you is to talk, especially with the current economic outlook, to talk a little bit about some of the funding scenarios for the bill. I know that in the last 4 or 5 weeks, this is the third time we've actually been in this boardroom with our current board members and a lot of the other board members, the folks from down in Worthington have been here, Superintendent Clark and a number of others have been here discussing this particular bill and trying to help understand it and help them look for it. There's a lot of skepticism, however, given the current economic outlook, given the fact that there is so much spending required to even get to the Chevy model level, and then given the projections of the deficit at the state level, just compounding. So I would encourage you to talk about some of the funding scenarios as well, so that people don't just sit back and say, well, this is never going to happen. Let's just, you know, forget it. It's just another broken promise that we have. And again, thank you for the opportunity to speak. Thanks for the
question. Thank you very much. I'll just address that a little bit, as long as there's no green cards up here. And I'll ask the raised hand. But as far as the funding, you know, one of the things, I've been invited to come to the MREA annual conference in Alexandria. I would guess a lot of you may be there. And one of the things that that was just suggested by my book, I think I will ask the staff if they're hearing it for the first time, if we came up with some funding scenarios where if the bill was funded at $100 million, what would that mean for every district, or if we put in, you know, the same amount we put in last session, or whatever, because I've heard some concern that we're not going to stick with the Eiffel Tower, you know, that there will be some end runs. Well, how about if you just do this, just do that? And as Lee Warren said, there's things in the bill that my district hates, my one type of district, that Representative Seifert's district case, he has other types and more than one, and the Representative Dietrich's district case. And they might all be different things, and then we all have things in here that we love. And to me, it is a package that we're hearing about, and we can change the package somewhat. But I am committed to the whole package. I do not really want to champion only the things that benefit my district or only the things that benefit this district or that district. That's why I call it the Eiffel Tower, so that we would implement everything to scale and then everything according to proportion gets funded. I even heard a rumor that somehow the metro legislators were going to say, let's just do the LEI, connect with all the other funding components, which is, that is definitely a rumor, folks, because even though the metro legislators would have the votes to do that, because there's a lot more of us in the legislature now, I would never, ever, ever even consider having my name on a bill or an amendment like that, because that would not be fair. And we have worked on a bill just like PS Minnesota did, where everybody has things they love, everybody has things they hate, and then we will try to get it as right as we can for the little model, and then we'll fund it to scale so that everybody's things that they love and hate get funded at the same rate based on how much money we put in. And my vision would be that would be three bienniums. Other people would probably like it to be 100 bienniums, and there might be some that would like us to do it all at once. I don't know who that would be, but that would probably be me, and I'm even willing to go for three bienniums given the financial climate. But given the financial climate, I just am convinced we can start it, because our state economist, Tom Simpson, said that the best way to jumpstart the economy is to invest in education. We can't not do it because of the economy. We must get started because of the economy. So we have 24 minutes. I see a hand. Superintendent Scott. We recognize him because when I used to go and watch the legislature, he was in our seat here. Welcome, and please state your name.
Madam Chair, I wasn't going to comment on the fact that I once sat in a position that in 1875, couldn't tell him in his name. A few years old, so I was on a legislative committee that came down to what then was the new Marshall High School. I tell you, it was a state-of-the-art school, and there was no primary building or anything as far as the state. And twice Marshall was proud of it, was very proud of the new school. And I had kind of trouble with the new one. Frank had met the building and come up, so that was something new. As you just said, there's a lot of good in this bill, there's a lot of things in the bill that you let just catch your own district because they say, no, we gotta get that out. But as a whole, this is a good piece of legislation. It makes some good public policy and it moves the state in the directions that I think the state needs to move. But we know that the specifics for changing the general area of the formula necessarily 7,500 or 7,400 or 8,000, but it's 23% times some complicated formula that started with Bill March in 1977. Those details can change, but the general framework is good. I looked at the chart and except for a couple of elementary family districts, my district's percent increase is at the lowest I can find. So we need to correct that. That goes back to the point that Superintendent Williams made that, you know, we've got a large elementary, Catholic elementary district, so we don't lose the ability to really pick up as much by the switch from 1.1 to 1.3 to 1 if you can get anybody else at 1. But apart from that, we're moving in the right direction. More dollars for education, all you have to do is look at the fund balances, the audit reports across the state, the school districts, and you see what's happening. Usually every district in the state goes back to this every year, and at some point, when they started to do, I don't know, they started to do lost their writers, so they stopped sending newspapers to the students, and we still haven't been getting the subscriptions, but we can't do that. And you as a legislature know that if the school district comes out of money, you know, if it's 6 miles down the road, it gives them all the buffalo like Hector, and if they have to pick them up on a motorcycle and transport them. But we have to run a school system that's accessible to students all across the state. Something has to be done. That brings me to the point that I'm most interested in the legislation of this. I don't really think you'll ever get enough money to vote policy. Some have to vote for something that says teacher education funding is distorted to an index adopted by the 2009 legislation. But I do think the point that's most important here is it's vitally important to appeal to a number that is realistic in limiting the cost of providing education in the region. There must be some time in the last 30 years when we felt that education was adequately funded in Minnesota. There has to be a point someplace. I don't know if it was 1971. I don't know if it was 1979. I don't know if it was just before the practice of somewhere that were growing in the country was possible in 1979 or 1976. But there must be a point when there's general agreement that education is adequately funded in the state. Let's go back to that. Come forward using the consumer price index or some other index that the economists or an all-time industries that would agree upon and see what that should be with you. And then we need to add to that all of the additional things you're asking us to do, whether it's the proficiency, special ed costs and assembly, I think it's, I wish to vote the state federal government according to my special education as a new promise. I went to a hearing at the 1975 Senator Javits Hill of New York. Senate file 6 of this call in public body 1942. And they were going to fund 40% of the state's minimum, 60%, and I think they're about 13 or 14%. So if you step up to the plate, 68% of your program is it's an improvement. And the small district, targeting students. If we suddenly are presented with a student with special education costs of $100,000 to $150,000 a year, it's virtually impossible for us to absorb that. Get 3,000 pupil units, 5,000 pupil units, 40,000 pupil units. There are some laws and averages that we do. But there are some really serious situations that are particularly more difficult for a small district. We have what I call catastrophic education expense. And I hope you address that. And then lastly, and I think the innovation is great. When you start setting aside 1.5% of $3 or $4 million, that's a nice chunk of money. What are you going to do? I'm the only administrator in our district. I don't have time to go out and develop a research based program. We're not alone. We want superintendents from the state. Then you have principal, half-time principal. When you get these tiny swimmers of money, I think our gifted and talented revenue this year is like $3,100. You know, it's nice. I appreciate it. Thank you. I asked Tom Melcher when we were in the media. I said, Tom, can I just save it up for 5 years till I have enough money to do something? Because these tiny swimmers of money, not workable. There is only program you can run that's 31 or 33 hours. $5,500. They're all $1,000. You just can't do anything. And maybe you need to do something where the reserve is under a certain dollar amount to move that reserve. And then I guess the last thing I would like to say is, when I was in the legislature, I somehow inherited this job and it's just been throwing everything at the families. That was young and asked me to take that day and I said, you're going to argue with this. But a lot of people, it's hard to argue against the wisdom of anything that comes out in terms of is this good? It's all good. But is it workable in every school district in the state exactly as it's written on the page? When you talk about local control, I submit to you we don't have local control in the state. We don't have very little local control. We have local school boards that have important responsibilities for this. But the highway has been explaining to my grandson the parallel lines, which are in the second grade of the Federal School System. So, see those two white lines that are parallel? It's pretty hard to stay between those lines all of the time. We need to, and that's what the rest of the local school board did. We all certified our preliminary levy this year. Find a school district that didn't certify the mats and what they didn't know they taught the same. If you really want local control up, you need to let us make some decisions on our own. But again, thank you very much. I need to thank you also for the regulations. James and Prime Minister, we're going to have to pass some of your
We will work at that. Thank you. Anybody else? We've got 12 minutes. We could end early, but we'd sure like to hear, since we came all this way, from anybody else if they would like to speak.
One thing I would like to comment on, under the Individual Disability Act, all of its reauthorizations, Part B, Sections 14, 15, and 16, are in direct conflict with AYP. Under those groups, only the IEP teams can set standards and raise and benchmarks. For special education students. However, I would dare to mention that a fair number of our schools did not make AYP due to our special education students. I have sent letters, 64 of them, to the Attorney General's office, our governor, our representatives, and to our federal officers, and asked them which one of the laws on the federal books I should violate. Because if I do one, I violate the other. If I don't do either one, I buy that vote. So I can't win. And so we have that challenge. Add to the fact that if we do not make AYP and are placed on the list, we have to do a set aside of 20% of our title money. Our title goes to our socioeconomic challenge gifts. So we're taking away the money that is in place to take care of the local group, of the lowest socioeconomic group. And we penalize them. I find that absolutely disgusting. With that, I'll get off my box.
You won't get any argument from us. And we feel like the federal government addresses some of these things, but we partner with you in that.
Representative, I offered to give $164,000 back to the state of Minnesota to leave us alone. Stakeholders that could not do that because our state accepts the money. And therefore, on behalf of the state, I must take it, and I must be penalized. I will assure you, statistics tells me, in any book I read on statistics, 100% of culpability, 100% satisfaction for 100% of our children is statistically impossible. So I'll give it back to them now. The joke about driving 6 miles is not a joke. We were noted in the U.S. News and World Report as a bronze winner, 100 top high schools in the United States against 18,000 that cannot meet the AYP because those kids came to us. We tested them on growth-based education system on the MAPS test on the Northwest Educational Assessment. They came to us of no fault of their own or their teachers. It has to do with the dysfunctional system. And they came to us and the best student that got to us out of the 112 students from that town was 6 months behind the benchmark. The worst case was 20 months. They came to us on average 18 months behind. We tested them, and we lose. We are a victim of our own success. And I find that appalling in my system. And the state says, I can't back out of it. I'll sit down.
Very good point. Anybody else? Okay, we'll go ahead any legislator want to say anything, including otherwise?
I want to thank everybody for coming. I think we heard a common theme about definite, I think, bipartisan applause for reform and trying to simplify the formula and new money. I think everyone agrees on it there. Probably the biggest concern, obviously, the Location Equity Index, which is close to $156 million. I don't know, almost all of the metro, Greg, or I suppose Rochester would get some. But they don't either? Okay. It's probably the biggest concern I've heard actually from emails as well from some people in this room I won't mention. Obviously, this is something we've tried in the past. The high school students now be multiplied times 1.3. Under this bill would be multiplied times 1, which hurts the school districts with appropriate school populations in my district. I've got a lot of Catholic schools, obviously. The interesting thing is the attention people have drawn on the addressing unfunded mandates, which we've got a bipartisan concern on, and I think this is more of a funding bill, but I think that's something that we can get suggestions from the group that we can build into the K-12 bill that would be helpful. I've heard concerns on the QCOMP being eliminated. Obviously, we've got districts that are very dependent on the QCOMP revenue, and that's a big concern of mine as well. Although my guess is that it'll magically appear when we get together in a negotiating session.
He knows about
bargaining. I know about bargaining, so. And then I think finally the way to pay for it, either finding it from other places or whatever it is, there needs to be a way to come up with it. But I like the idea that there's a goal in place. I like the idea someone brought up that we should not be passing this bill last, it should be passed first. It should be passed in time for us to read it, which is not, under both bodies, both parties, has not done a very good job of doing that. So people in this room can read it, so you don't get an email from your association on May 19th and saying the legislature is voting on this in 3 hours, give us your input. If you have had no chance, and Melcher's phone melts down at the department because you're trying to figure out how it affects your school district. And so I think there's a lot of concern, and we hear that. I know that the other areas have had testimony in that, but at least we have something we can look at, and hopefully the concerns will be addressed, and we can take a look at getting this bill passed first. So I just want to thank everyone for coming.
And I would reiterate that, and I think we can bipartisanly push to have this bill be first, because I would like it to be House file number one, and Representative Dietrich and I would certainly join. I think that I could speak for both of us in having education not be the last bill, which makes it the budget balancer, if someone called it a bargaining chip or a pawn or whatever, and that, you know, that has happened the last several bienniums, and that should not be the case. Once superintendent said it, the first thing in the Constitution, and that it should be first. And I concur with that a lot. We have a lot of things to discuss. We've heard good suggestions. Some are things we've heard around the state, and some are new things that we made note of and will look at when we're refining the bill for next January. And we hope you'll continue giving us input and pushing for it. It is a hard-fought, negotiated agreement, and things like that keep percolating along. And yes, QCOMP really ought to be back. I agree before we get that. So thank you very much, and we'll be around a little bit for those who won't run off to the debate. And we can adjourn.